This is a CBC podcast.
Support for delivery of this podcast comes from Chevrolet. At Chevrolet, we bring people together with the things that matter to them most. Visit chevrolet.gm.ca.
Hello, I'm Heather Brown. Welcome to the Between the Covers podcast, where we're presenting The Stone Carvers by award-winning author Jane Urquhart. The novel travels widely, both in time and place. It begins in a field in France, where work is proceeding on a stone memorial to Canadian soldiers who went missing in action in France during World War I. At that time, in an isolated village in Ontario, we meet our central character, Clara Becker, who is living alone as a spinster. The novel then takes us back to the mid-1800s, when the village was just a clearing in the woods, and her grandfather Joseph is a very young man who devoted his passion for carving to work for his God and his church. In this episode, Clara is a young woman just emerging from adolescence. She's already discovered she shares her grandfather's passion for carving. Now, she and young Eamon O'Sullivan are basking in the glow of a first love.
June of 1914 was followed by a summer of beauty, warmth, and calm. A summer that would be mythologized all over the Western world in the years to come. In Chauneval, insects attacked not one green leaf of the swiftly growing crops. Animals fattened in dew-soaked pastures. Parishioners attended mass regularly and confession infrequently, there being apparently few sins to confess. Clara worked in the mornings on the wooden abbess, and during the afternoons on the waistcoat promised to Eamon. In the evenings, she walked out with him down dusty roads, or through orchards, or across the cemetery. Often he was silent, as was his nature, but now they remained physically close, hands and shoulders touching, or with his arm across her shoulders, so that quietness became a connection rather than a separation. By July, it seemed that every one of Clara's senses had opened to the light of the long, long days. The scent of freshly chiseled wood in the shop, or of cloth in the sunroom, the taste of salt on new potatoes, the coolness of a damp cloth on her neck in the morning. In her workshop, the face of the abbess softened to such an extent that Clara's grandfather became concerned. "This abbess," he said, "is too young, and far too cheerful. She looks as if she has spent most of her short life dreaming in a field of flowers. No man would accept advice from her. No pope would listen to her for 1 minute." Clara was stung by this criticism, but only briefly, and the tears cleared in minutes. All the rest of the day she was thinking of the moments when Eamon's arm was on her shoulder or his hands were in her hair. Late on certain afternoons after work, Eamon and Clara would remove shoes and stockings and step into the bed of the clear-running creek that drove the machinery of the brewery, Eamon with his pant legs rolled up and Clara carrying her skirt in front of her thighs as if it were a sheaf of wheat. They followed the path of the water into an area surrounded by thick brush and cedar, lifting their legs over fallen logs and pushing aside the branches of aspen and poplar that grew near the bank. Eventually, they would reach a series of pools, each slightly larger than the last. The final pond, which had water deep enough for swimming, was ringed by willows around its circular edge. Eamon, covered with sweat from work, would immediately throw off his clothing, then would flail with much splashing into the water. Clara, shyer, removed her own clothes on a bank behind a willow and stepped into a deep area protected by a curtain of green leaves where Eamon was unable to see her. "I'm coming in there," Eamon would tease. Then he would dive under the surface and emerge in a fountain of water, claiming that he had glimpsed Clara's legs. She lay on her back and looked up through soft green, or she stood waist-deep in the water and floated her open hands on a dark surface covered with echoes of light. The shadows of leaves were like bruises on her skin. There was a kind of communion in this separate baptism. Though they couldn't see each other or touch, they were connected by the pool and by laughter, by the pleasure of the chilled water on warm skin, the shadows, the breeze. On one such day, as she stood in her green water hut, A startled Clara, hands held to her head to protect herself from the noise, watched between two long strands of willow as Eamon, who had just entered the pond, threw his head back and looked at the sky, his face lit by the full flood of the sun, and then covered briefly by a swift, clamorous shadow that changed for the space of a breath the color of his skin and the color of the pond. She continued to stare as he climbed swiftly up the bank, struggled unself-consciously into his trousers, unknowingly permitting Clara her first full view of his oddly delicate naked self. She remained shivering behind the green shield, her arms crossed protectively over her breasts. Having registered the places where his black, tufted hair interrupted white skin, and how his sex shone between his legs. Then she moved quickly toward her clothing and dressed herself as the catastrophic noise sputtered and eventually stopped altogether. A great calamity had occurred, she knew. Something fierce and dire had fallen from the sky. This was the first time in Clara's life that anything other than familiar, comforting sounds had entered her afternoons. And this was the first time in her presence that Eamon had turned his attention away from her. When she stepped furtively out of the woods and into an open field, she saw, near the opposite fence line, two men, one of whom was Eamon, standing beside a contraption apparently constructed of sticks and canvas. Clara called to him, wanting him to forget about this uninvited machine that had, she felt, already come strangely between them. But Eamon beckoned to her enthusiastically, and as she came near, shouted at her in an almost hysterical voice, "Clara, come look! An aeroplane!" "An aeroplane," she repeated stupidly, quietly to herself. She knew about them, of course, but had thought they would be more seraphic, graceful. In her imagination, they had been white, gliding and silent, a miracle lifted by wind. This machine looked, as she approached it, more like some ill-designed gadget from the mill or the brewery, and it smelled of grease and filth. The pilot turned to her as she walked toward them and explained that he had run out of petrol on his way from Owen Sound to a fair at Goderich. Clara stared at his leather boots, which were cracked and covered with oily stains. She realized she had left her own boots at the pool and self-consciously covered one foot with the other. Eamon was running his hands lovingly over the propeller. "My God," he said, "this is the most beautiful thing." "She could use some tidying up," said the pilot, as he opened one hinged part of the nose. "There's so many fares now, I hardly have the time. Can I get petrol in the village?" "I'll show you where there's a tank by the mill." Eamon was examining the instrument panel. "Good. And then I'll take you for a spin afterwards." The pilot looked at Clara, at her hair, her breasts, her bare feet. "And then I'll take you up." "No," said Clara firmly. "Thank you."
"You'll take me up?"
said Eamon, incredulous. "Sure, why not?"
"Don't go, Eamon,"
said Clara. She didn't want him floating through the clouds, no longer anchored to their own village landscape, to the earth. She wanted to be lying on her back beside the pool with him, smoothing her long hair out to dry in the sun, the familiar grass surrounding them both. There was nothing Clara could do to prevent Eamon from riding in the airplane. Later, when the pilot was filling the machine with petrol, she began to walk away.
"Aren't you even going to stay and watch?"
Eamon called after her, his voice high and strained in disbelief. She didn't answer, but kept striding toward the wood where she had left her boots. While she was tying her laces, she heard the machine start up. The noise shook the leaves of all the trees around her and seemed to leave visible fissures in the atmosphere. As the aeroplane brushed over the topmost branches, she crouched on the ground and bent her arms over her head. Eventually, the apparatus landed and set Eamon free. He was in a state of great agitation.
"Wasn't that something?" he kept saying to no one in particular. "Wasn't that something?"
After the beast had once again hurled itself into the air and had droned into the distance, Eamon turned to Clara and began to talk excitedly. He told her that everything looked so small from that height. He could have held Shaunaval in the palm of his hand.
"You became so tiny," he said. "I could hardly find you."
In the middle of August, and after many fittings, Clara finished the waistcoat. The evening he came to collect the garment, he burst into a room tinted orange by dusk and kissed Clara, first on the neck and then on the soft skin of her inner elbow. She held the coat open for him, and he maneuvered his body into it, then solemnly buttoned the front. The setting sun shone through the window and brought out the red tints in his black hair. Even his eyelashes reflected light. Clara had never seen anyone so beautiful. He grinned at her and opened his arms, but she shook her head. "I just want to look at you," she said. He walked back and forth across the room with his eyes locked to hers. "It's perfect," said Eamon, laughing, his face illuminated by the sun. Clara felt as if she were bathing in the copper light that drenched the room, felt that each time she inhaled, her bloodstream became luminous. She was practically suffocated by radiance. "Eamon," she said, testing his name, the shape of it in her mouth. He did not answer, but walked across the floor toward her, removed the coat, folded it carefully, and placed it on the seat of a ladder-backed chair. Stepping closer to Clara, who was made motionless by his nearness, Eamon for the first time tentatively moved his warm hand down the side of her neck, over her collarbone, under the cotton fabric. When his fingers grazed her nipple, she gasped and drew back, frightened by the new nerve connections that were like plucked strings resonating in her belly, her inner thighs. "No," she whispered, "I can't." Then they were holding each other, locked together, staggering against the chair, which overturned so that the splendid coat lay discarded, a prone torso beside them where they fell on the floor. Clara cried out once in pain, then felt herself sink into an unrecognizable ache of tenderness. And then when it was over, she recalled the afternoon they had skated on the ice, how they had fallen there. They dressed quietly, avoiding each other's eyes, private in the wake of the experience. Eamon picked up the coat and smoothed it over his arm. Then he reached forward and grasped her hands. "Is it all right, Clara?" "Yes," she said, and then more firmly, "Yes." "We'll be married," he said. "We'll get married. My father, he'll live with us. We'll live here. He'll want what makes you happy," said Eamon. Clara said nothing. She was thinking about the curve of Eamon's shoulders, the fine white skin there, the unfamiliar dark hair she had seen when he had clambered out of the pool toward the airplane, how there had been just a glimpse of it when they lay together. Then she'd closed her eyes again. "Would you want to be married to me?" he asked. "Yes," she said. "Yes, of course." It surprised her now to realize that she'd never even once thought about marriage, the future, as if she would be caught in this lush, youthful summer forever. Then she heard the sound of her father's boots in the woodshed and his slow, steady progress through the downstairs rooms of the house. He had returned from the neighboring farm where he had gone to buy some eggs and was calling her name as he passed through the parlor. "I'm up here," she called back. Only then thinking that he might have returned sooner, and that if he had, he likely would not have been noticed. "Eamon has come for his coat." Eamon and Clara exchanged glances, embarrassed by an awareness of a possible discovery. Suddenly Clara was able to imagine the act as if she had been a witness rather than a participant, as if she had stood outside herself and watched the senseless awkwardness of their lovemaking. She felt that she had been ushered by Eamon into a heated, adult world where men and women clutched at each other, wrestled, collapsed on the floor. Then the moment passed and they embraced, Eamon burying his face in the warmth of Clara's neck. But the outer world was not to be ignored. "Come down," Dieter Becker was calling. "Come down and bring Silent Irish with you. There's news. War has been declared."
Nikki Guadagni, reading Episode 6 of The Stone Carvers by Jane Urquhart. When we continue, Father Justeer finally sees his dream of a stone cathedral begin to take shape, and we'll also see how the news of war invaded Clara's summer of love. The novel is published by Viking Press. You can subscribe to this podcast at cbc.ca/podcasting.
Hi, I'm Nora Young, the host of Spark on CBC Radio. What is Spark, you ask? Well, Spark is...
Spark is online.
Spark is interactive.
Spark is a conversation.
Spark is digital.
Spark is a new kind of radio show.
You can check out the Spark blog, contribute to the show, and download the podcast at cbc.ca/spark.